Dear listeners, welcome to Faces of Digital Health, a podcast about digital health and how healthcare systems adopt technologies. My name is Tiasza Zajc, and this is the first part of a short series about digital health in Asia, where you will get an overview of the region and insight in Singapore, South Korea, China, and India. Asia is the second largest digital health ecosystem in the world. 2018 ended with a record-breaking $6.3 billion invested in the region. According to IBC Asia, the digital health market is expected to reach $379 billion by 2024. Asian countries are leapfrogging the West in tech adoption. Many countries are turning into cashless societies where all transactions are done through mobile phones. At the same time, the culture in Asia is very different compared to the West. For a light start, the first episode will give you a broad overview of the region with Julian de Salaberry from Gallen Growth Asia. But before that, a few interesting thoughts about China, India, Singapore, and South Korea from speakers in the upcoming episodes. First, China with Julie Wang, who currently works for a platform provider, Linked Care.
The Chinese consumers do not talk much about data privacy. It probably does not mean that they don't care internally, deep in their mind. But I think they definitely require a lot more of privacy compared with data privacy, and more specifically in digital health and healthcare. Good health service is very rare resource in China because of the population. So if you look at the doctor to population ratio, good quality health service is a very rare resource. So compared with data privacy, people care much more about getting a better quality of health service. So if you imagine consumers purchasing health monitoring trackers, for example, they value the benefits that are brought by the tracker a lot more than they care about their data privacy. So I think it's, again, a result of the population and the current level of our health service in China.
China and India have roughly the same population. India, which you will hear about from Sunil Anand and Kartik Dar from Project Echo, is currently implementing a huge program to give the poor population access to healthcare.
Last year itself, the government took on this very ambitious program of ensuring 500 million Indians, that's almost 45% of the Indian population. Indian healthcare system needs this. 60% of the money is out paid to be out of pocket, out of, you know, the money that people use for healthcare is unacceptable on a long-term basis. In some states, 50% of the population, people who go for treatment go below the poverty line because of that. Modi Care really addresses the healthcare delivery to the poor people. The problem is not, I think, in the thought process. I think the problem is more in the fear of delivery. How are you going to deliver such huge healthcare to people with the infrastructure that exists? Remember, India spends very little of the GDP on health, 1-2%. So that's, I think, the politicians were more concerned on raising it. One, because elections are there, they have got to criticize. And two is that it is actually an operational challenge. It's not easy to build the capacity in the entire public healthcare system to cater to such a large population joining healthcare.
Singapore definitely can't compare to India with its small population of 5.8 million people. As explained by Tony Estrella, an investor, advisor, and a fiction novelist currently based in Singapore, the country is already pushing forward tech development with well-designed IT infrastructure.
Another thing that not just Singapore does, but other countries are doing is creating data sandboxes where private industry can collaborate using public data in a private safe way to be able to advance solution development and innovation. And I think that the smart city approach and linking that to the ability to create new solutions with good data sources behind it is, I think, a critical element of any country in thinking through how to spur and stimulate growth and improvement in health outcomes.
The last country we'll hear about in this special series about digital health in Asia is South Korea. Healthcare access there is so well designed that telemedicine is actually illegal, says Ogan Gurel.
Korea is very advanced in terms of infrastructure. A lot of people have talked about 5G. And ironically, Korea is fairly less advanced in the area of telemedicine. And the reason is twofold. One is access to healthcare is very easy in Korea. To get on a, you know, telemedicine and talk to a doctor from your home with the webcam or whatever, as opposed to just going down the street to see them, and you don't need an appointment, you just show up and generally you're seen within 20 minutes, maybe less than an hour, depends. The point is, you don't need to have a telemedicine solution as compared to, say, the United States or in, you know, very geographically dispersed areas, Australia, Indonesia, Africa, and so forth. The second reason telemedicine is not widespread in Korea is it's in fact illegal. And there's a concern among the neighborhood doctors that if there's telemedicine, the patients will then connect to all the academic medical centers and that the local doctors will suffer because of that.
Do subscribe to the podcast so you'll be notified when each of these episodes will be published. And now, to the overview of the region with Julien de Celeberry, founder and CEO of Galen Growth. Galen Growth is the leading exclusive health tech research, analytics and advisory firm in Asia-Pac, based in Singapore. Julien lived in various countries across Asia before founding Galen Growth. You will hear him reflect on the time spent in the region and his observations of China, India, Singapore and smaller players such as Vietnam. Julien, welcome. My first question is, you are currently based in Singapore, is that correct?
I'm currently based in two locations. So Singapore certainly is where our headquarters are for Galen Growth Asia and where we first incorporated. We have a second location that is in Basel in Switzerland, which is where our European operations are based.
What made you move to Asia in the first place, and how do you manage, you know, the time zones if you travel so much, if you're based in two places?
Good question. Well, my move to Asia is a long story. It happened back in 2002. When I moved with the corporation I was working with, they relocated me to Sydney in Australia with an Asia Pacific set of accountabilities. From there, I moved to Japan and spent a number of years there, again, focusing on Asia Pacific. And then from there, I moved to Singapore, where I have been for the last 11 years, initially with working for a very large pharmaceutical company. And then I left employment to become self-employed. Entrepreneur, I guess, these days, and established a couple of organizations, of which one is an early stage investment platform for digital health, and the other is Galen Growth Asia, which is the catalyst for the Asia-Pac digital health ecosystem.
Before we dive into digital health systems and the market state in Asia, based on your travels, based on the countries that you lived in, could you make a brief overview on what caught your attention most culturally wise?
Oh, they're very incredibly different. Asia-Pac has different levels of maturity as well as very strong cultural differences. It's a little reminiscent of you know, the European Union, I guess, with you know, one union of 27 countries, but all of them quite distinct of each other. You have mature markets such as, you know, Japan, Australia, which have very developed healthcare ecosystems, but also very different cultures, very different reimbursement mechanisms. Then you've got what I would call developing markets, such as the China or India of Asia Pacific, which have significant demographics and very different ways of going about overhauling their own healthcare systems, again, with their own cultural differences. China is much more directive, autocratic, whereas India is much more democratic in its approach. And then, of course, a third tier, which is what I would call the new frontier markets, the Myanmars, Laoses, et cetera, you know, of this world, which are really starting from ground zero and, again, have their own regulations, their own, where they have them, that is, their own systems, and then, of course, their own desire to do their own thing. And so one of the golden rules, I guess, of anyone looking at Asia Pacific is you should not treat it as one block. And you should certainly not think that the fact that you're being successful in one particular country means you will be successful in the neighboring country or within another market in Asia Pacific.
When you moved to Asia, were you subjected to a cultural shock? For example, there's a book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And it highlights how different the culture in Asia is, how much silence is more appreciated compared to the West, where talking is glorified, where extroversion is glorified.
That's a fair observation. In terms of your question on culture shock, well, inevitably, yes. I mean, when I arrived in Australia, of course, not so much in terms that I had left the UK to move to Australia. So I was moving from one Anglo-Saxon country to another Anglo-Saxon country. You know, other than understanding the rules and regulations that are different, the approach to life is fairly similar. But then when I moved to Tokyo, there really you realize that Asia is very different. The language, culture, traditions all have an enormous bearing on the way in which a country operates, and therefore an enormous influence on the way in which people do business or access healthcare, etc. And that contrast existed again when I arrived in Singapore, which is often referred to as Asia for beginners, because really it's kind of that midway house between Asian culture, but an Asian culture that has absorbed and adopted an awful lot of Western business practices, habits, technologies, brands, etc. And so you end up with a different experience completely.
I think there's a general rule that when it comes to a lot of new markets, you need a strong local partner. Can you offer some observation or advice on how do you even start looking for a local partner coming from the West?
Strongest and best and most reliable way of doing this is to get a referral. In other words, get somebody who has experience and is trusted already within the field in which you're playing, but also within the business arena and the business activities that you're trying to address or to access. If you don't have that luxury, then of course you do need to step in to that particular country and do your homework. And that really is networking, very quickly understanding, I guess, who does what in that particular market and make some progress in relation to trying to build bridges, build trust, and move forward from there. Coming back to your point around that book, whereby, you know, silence is more valued in Asia than it is, say, in the Western world. I would say so. Often enough, that silence is important for your local face-off. Because no doubt you're having to interact with them in English and they need time to fully understand what it is you just said to them in English in order to be able to give you an informed answer, response to your question generally.
Unrelated, did you learn any new languages while living in Asia?
I certainly learned a fair amount of Japanese when I was living in Japan. It's essential. It's the only way you can operate, navigate, even just on the day-to-day life basis, ignoring for 2 seconds the requirements of working in the office. And the office I worked in was really 50-50 Japanese versus international, let's say. I certainly have learned some Mandarin, again, in order to be able to, let's call it, survive as I operate in China. But I would not call my language standards in Asia to be technical enough to be able to conduct business at any level of sophistication.
I find all these differences in cultures really fascinating when it comes to technology, design and adoption. You mentioned that you lived in Japan, and Japan is known for its progress in AI and robotics. But what I think is really important there is that the culture is so different when it comes to the whole attitude towards robots. I had an interview 2 years ago with two Japanese ladies, and one of them explained to me that, for example, in the West, the first association to robots is the Terminator, whereas the Japanese see robots as friends, as part of their family.
So when I was living in Japan, there was far less of that. I think the robotic phenomenon, let's call it that, in Japan is a more recent one. I left Japan in 2008, and it's really an enormous response by a country that has an aging population that is growing or has grown to significant proportions as a percentage of the overall population, along with local rules and regulations that limit the easy access, let's say, to foreign manpower. And so the emphasis on technology has grown substantially in the last decade, which is why we've seen some substantial advances in Japan around the use of robotics, not just in the operating theater, but also in aged care, for example.
Gallon Growth published a nice report about the Asian market in 2018, and it has become clear that Asia is the second digital health market in the world. $6.3 billion were invested last year, and the top countries were South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, India, Singapore, Indonesia, and Australia. I was wondering, what about places such as Vietnam, Indonesia, or the Philippines? Or, yeah, how do you see them? What's the situation there?
So, yes, right. So we, again, in Growth Asia, have built the most comprehensive, most advanced data and analytics platform, entirely focused, should I say, on digital health in the region. And for us, the region is from Pakistan furthest west to, say, China furthest east, and then from Japan down to New Zealand. So we really do look at every single market. We're certainly very excited to see how the Asia Pacific ecosystem has grown. In Q1 of 2019, Asia Pacific Digital Health raised more funding than the US. And that's despite the current geopolitical differences between the US and China. That's a report we release every 6 months, and we look at it in different ways every time we publish it in terms of how we look at each market. We tend to always focus on those countries such as India and China, largely because they are the gorillas in the room. And then, of course, we focus on the markets that have substantial share of the ecosystem. And by share of ecosystem, I mean percentage of total health tech, digital health, startup venture population. Singapore being a case in point, whereby because of the nature of Singapore as a trading nation, as a geopolitical, should I say, center of Southeast Asia and various other attributes, it attracts an awful lot of ventures, either encouraged by their investors to relocate or because the Singapore government has done a great job of investing in the ecosystem to grow the local innovation and talent. With regard to the other markets, we do track them very carefully, to refer one of the countries you spoke about. Vietnam, at this stage, is certainly a fast-moving, burgeoning, roughly speaking, has 1% to 2% ecosystem share. Vietnam, I would suggest, based on the data we have, has an emphasis on more patient journey type innovation. In other words, how does a patient seeking either to become more aware or to access healthcare or even to afford healthcare, how do they leverage technology to do so, or how do they leverage technology to get better value for money by at least do some comparisons in between services. Southeast Asia, or should I suggest Asia, excluding Japan, Korea, China, India, Australia, which are very large markets, is certainly in the last 12 months seen a very strong growth, both in terms of birth of innovation, but also in terms of a focus from investors and from multinationals, such as, say, big pharmaceutical companies.
When you're explaining how the market is growing, are investors from the West also moving to Asia? Is there some fear that perhaps the Asian market would grow strong to move the innovations to the West? Or is that an unnecessary fear because the cultures are so different and the uptake of solutions is different on different markets? So you really have to know where you're selling what.
Yeah, so it's an interesting, very interesting question because, of course, you can look at different ways. You can look at it at through the eyes of a let's say a startup venture which has experienced some success in Europe or in the US and is looking at Asia Pacific as a potential route to scaling. We see a growing interest. The caution we always share with a founder or CEO of a European or US digital health venture is that they need to really give a lot of hard thought as to their market entry strategy, but more importantly, as to their business model. The fact that it works well in the UK does not mean that it will work well in Singapore or in China. I think most founders I talk to know that at the back of their minds, but it takes them a while to realize that actually they need to rethink their business model completely in order to really get traction on the ground. We are seeing significant growth and appetite from multinationals, and so those that are generally globally headquartered in Europe or in the US, who I think are finally, when I say finally, I'm talking about the last 12 to 18 months, but come to the right conclusion, and that is that the relationship with the patient, the consumer, lies with the patient and that consumer, which is very different to some of the other regions, and that therefore they need to figure out how they engage with that consumer and that patient from a digital perspective. They also understand and need to grasp through their own endeavors and partnerships with local innovators, you know, how they, I guess, maintain some sort of engagement with that relationship versus potentially losing that relationship completely because a very smart digital health venture has a value proposition that attracts the patient towards them. So you can imagine it's an interesting challenge within a large organization that is investing a lot of money in its digital marketing capability, its multi-channel capability, trying to influence a physician or trying to influence a consumer, when in fact that consumer and that physician are seeking information from new third parties, be they both new entrants or simply you know, a new startup. Investors are quite interesting. We are generally seeing a pattern of investors deploying funding from their own local or regional offices rather than all the way from Europe or from the US. And I think that makes sense in terms of having a local team who understands the ecosystem making the decisions. What we are seeing is the geopolitical differences that are growing in number in Europe with, say, Brexit, in the US with, say, some of the North American treaty differences, or even the big differences with China, is, I guess, a bit of a paradigm shift where a lot of investors have always regarded Europe and the US as stable. You know, you could predict more or less the way the economy was going to grow, and therefore you could make decisions accordingly. And therefore, that was always in contrast with a lot of the Asian markets. I think those assumptions have been more or less turned on their head, which means that, you know, in fact, are we looking at certain markets in Asia with potentially greater degrees of stability going forward, as far as investors are concerned, than you have, say, in Europe and the US. Now, it's a question mark rather than an affirmation. But I think some of these, that's, this question is being asked by a number of the larger investors.
In April 2019, President Trump ordered the Chinese majority owner of the healthcare company Patients Like Me to sell his stake. Since we're talking about the geopolitical situations, how did you see this move?
Very unfortunate for Patients Like Me. I mean, this is my point of view. I read it that an organization was being used as an example in order to intimidate further investment from Chinese mainland into technology and know-how and talent in the US. The plus side, we are watching very carefully to see what that means. That, you know, in other words, are we like to see Chinese mainland investors starting to look at other regions as far as getting access to technology, know-how, and scale? And therefore, are we going to see a faster inbound velocity of funding from Chinese mainland investors in Asia Pacific more broadly and or Europe?
3 years ago, when investments in digital health started picking up, I recorded a short documentary with the industry leaders about the hopes and hypes around digital health. I think at that time it wasn't quite clear where everything is going. There was more of this notion that the innovators think that just by going digital, all the problems are going to be solved. I think that today, based on the already gathered data about the patient behavior and about the consumerism of healthcare, the situation is much more clear. There's more clarity about these topics and the potentials and the development of digital health. You started Yale and Growth in 2015. Do you think you can offer a reflection on the development of the market and solutions that you're observing?
No, absolutely. I mean, obviously, our point of view is our lens is Asia Pacific. My journey in digital health in Asia Pacific started, in fact, as far back as mid-2012, when my other business started investing in digital health, early stage digital health platforms. And at that stage, we realized that we were probably a little early. Over the last 3.5 years, we've certainly seen a very different speed. I think you're right. For some time, a lot of the ecosystem's incumbents, at least, felt that digital health was a bit of a fashion. We needed time to see the innovators proving their concept and then proving value. In Asia Pacific, what we've seen is the patient has really the power and really will be the driver of that change. And therefore, traction by digital health ventures at a patient level has grown substantially. There's a venture, for example, in Singapore called Healint, which is focused on migraine as an ailment or a disease. You know, it has quietly built a total number of patients which daily use its platform in excess of 1.5 million patients. So no small amount for a digital therapeutic player. There's another business which works across Southeast Asia as a whole called Hello Health, which has, to all sense of purpose, I would describe it, I guess, as the WebMD of Asia Pacific. But they have 35 million unique users using their platform for greater awareness of disease, etc. Back in late 2015, early 2016, there was still a certain amount of hesitation, timidity, as far as the space was concerned. The first sector really to engage and start leveraging the capabilities and innovation in the space was insurers. Or the life side of insurance started looking at digital health innovation as a means of getting greater engagement with life policyholders. So that was really the first inflection point in the digital health space in Asia Pacific. But in the past 12 months to 18 months, we've seen substantial appetite and physical engagement, sustainable engagement from incumbents such as medical device companies, pharmaceutical companies, consumer firms, etc. All of them have all come to the same conclusion, which is that technology is rapidly becoming what is generally called the last mile between the provider or the manufacturer, let's say, and the end patient or end consumer.
One of the things that I found very interesting in the report for 2018 was that the top three IPOs from the Chinese market were all about population health management. I thought that was interesting, you know, because China is so big and it's becoming a real surveillance state. So a lot of foreign countries are coming in to see the surveillance system that China is developing. So I'm wondering what's going to happen if this gets translated in the healthcare space.
To your first point, yes, you're right. Some of the larger deals or IPOs in China during the course of 2018 were players such as Ping An Good Doctor or We Doctor, which raised substantial sums of money and are in the same sort of category, population health management. We believe that the core driver for that is the Chinese government's directive that technology will fast-track the deployment of better delivery of healthcare, certainly at a primary care level. You only have to look at the Chinese government's guidelines issued in April of 2018, which is called Internet Plus Medicine, where the government clearly lays out the fact that it expects technology to play a central role as to the transformation of healthcare. And you know, it's easy to know why when you go to China and you look at delivery of healthcare. All the primary care is delivered at a hospital level, and the patient consumer has little trust in the smaller hospitals. There are three levels of hospitals in China. One, two, and three, and then you get the three plus, which are the super hospitals, and they're the ones that tend to be trusted and tend to attract most of the patients. So it's not uncommon to find yourself queuing for 3 to 4 hours to see a physician in one of these hospitals. Once you get to see the physician, it's not uncommon to find that you're only there for 4 or 5 minutes. So you can see why there's a desperate need to reduce the burden on these hospitals and try and push or triage, certainly, the more simpler cases, let's say, of primary care over to technology so as to remove the patient from that queue, from that hospital. But China has its issues. You know, 80% of Chinese healthcare resources are in one part of the country, but 80% of the population lives in a different part of the country. You know, it's that rural-urban dichotomy. they are certainly very strong users of technology as to how they choose to manage resources in the country. And we see lots of headlines and reports as to how they go about doing so. You know, they have the demographics to be able to push through some very interesting developments from an innovation perspective. And, you know, kind of linked to a point you made in I think the previous question, in terms of the innovation in Asia Pacific and how we're seeing that become more and more sophisticated. In the early stages of digital health in Asia Pacific, we saw a predominance of patient solutions coming through, or patient journey type solutions, you know, of seeking information, finding a doctor, etc. If you look at the report more specifically, if you look at our forthcoming report, which will be due out in July for the whole of the first half of 2019, the readers will see that what we're seeing is a growing attractiveness, let's say, or a growing number of ventures in Asia Pacific, China included, which are very much focused on a more sophisticated side of healthcare. And what I mean by that, looking at AI drug discovery, looking at clinical trial management through digital means, etc. So some really exciting developments and really a demonstration of the level of sophistication that we're seeing bubbling through from the digital health ecosystem in Asia Pacific.
Asia used to be quite known for medical tourism. Do you see any upgrade of that with the rise of digital health market?
Well, there's certainly an overlap. You're right. There are some medical tourism centers or centers of excellence, let's say, in Asia, notably Bangkok and Singapore, but KL is growing as well. Sorry, Kuala Lumpur. What we are seeing is greater use of technology by those providers in order to enable essentially comparison shopping and being able to make a selection, I guess, as to what service you want. What is probably translating into, I imagine, is that medical tourism is moving from really what was the privilege of the few to a greater reach in terms of a population looking to address acute need, you know, in another market. But that's I think it's still early days. And what I mean by that, for example, is how would a middle-class office worker in Indonesia potentially seek care in another country, largely because the same intervention is cheaper in that other country, be it Bangkok or be it India, etc. So yes, there is an overlap. We're not seeing yet seeing a major shift in business model, but we are certainly seeing a great adoption of digital platforms, let's say, either through partnership or through building internally by the providers of medical tourism.
While living in different countries in Asia, did you by any chance have any experiences with the healthcare systems so you could, you know, share the user experience in different systems?
Not often. I do my best to stay as healthy as possible. So it's very rare that I actually leverage the health system of that country. Australia's, where I live for 4 years, only at a primary care level, very similar mechanism to the UK. The nuance I found when I was there was the fee being charged by a physician's practice for a consultation, which was welcomed by myself, largely because it seemed to address some of the issues that a physician's practice have by way of no shows or time wasters when you're managing a primary care practice, which is an issue in the UK. But certainly the policy of bringing in a consultation fee at a primary care level in the UK is one that's been discussed but never been adopted. In Japan, I don't think I ever had to consult any type of healthcare in Japan. But it's certainly interesting to hear the anecdotes from Japanese and other international colleagues stroke friends in Japan as to what their experience is like. The delivery of healthcare in Japan is still very conventional, as has just been discovered by a small number of startups that I'm aware of have tried to move from Europe and the US to Japan and have found it incredibly difficult. I can't remember the average age of a physician in Japan. I may be wrong here, but I think it's 65 plus. So that demographic alone gives you a flavor of, or an insight really, as to, you know, how much technology adoption is visible within a physician's practice, for example.
During your research, did you come across any solutions that you thought were more interesting than others or that were very specific and caught your attention? For example, a few years ago in the G4A accelerator, I met a startup that was working on smart breathing masks for the Chinese market because the air pollution is a problem, or at least was in Beijing at the time.
Every year we run the only dedicated digital health summit in Asia Pacific. It happens in Singapore every November. It's an opportunity for us to award a most innovative startup for that year. Last year we awarded this to a startup in Indonesia called Halodoc, which is spelled Halodoc. You know, they've built an interesting platform. You know, there you're seeing technology which is getting great adoption and traction at a patient level, backed by the other successful startup in Indonesia called Gojek, which is a motorbike ride hailing platform. And if anyone's ever been to Indonesia, or more specifically Jakarta, they will know that traffic is an absolute nightmare, and you should allow at least an hour to 2 hours to be able to get between two meeting points in Jakarta during rush hour, if not during the rest of the day. What Jonathan's managed to build with his team is a platform that allows the patient to find a physician, visit the physician, get a script fulfilled, and get their lab tests all in one end-to-end type seamless offering. The interesting thing in terms of what he's achieved, other than that seamless end-to-end value proposition to the patient, is that from a script fulfillment perspective only, in other words, now I've got the script from the physician, they at Halodoc are able to fulfill scripts in 20 different cities across Indonesia in less than 1 hour, which is a huge improvement in quality of life as well as time saving, etc., for the patient. The resulting effect of that is that he's just closed his Series B for $65 million, which is I think probably the largest Series B in Southeast Asia, at least. So there's some very exciting developments. But exciting is not always just driven by the technology; it's also driven by the business model. And I'm sure you and your listeners will acknowledge the fact that in some cases technology can be simple, but the business model is a smart piece in terms of how you sustainably and profitably bring the same offering to patients.
Since you mentioned the significant time saving of Halodoc, that reminds me of an Indian startup that I came across in 2017. And what they did was basically laboratory tests at home. So a phlebotomist would come to your home and just take the blood, so you wouldn't have to lose time with going to the laboratory, and they would then take care of taking that to testing.
When you have ever been to or lived in Delhi or in Mumbai, where the traffic is as bad as it is in Jakarta, those type of services mean a great deal to the individual, who has a full-time job and usually has quite a significant family or relatives to feed, in inverted commas.
Maybe just one more question. Is there anything specific that you would like to share about India?
So we're watching India very carefully. We saw some really interesting investment behavior last year. What we are seeing is certainly a very buoyant innovation sector. By our best mapping of the ecosystem, I would say that India care or digital health ecosystem is as big, if not slightly bigger, than China. It just attracts far less funding. In fact, it's in the order of 1 to 10 almost. For every $1 invested in India, about $10 are invested in China, to give you a flavor. The interesting thing we've noted is that there's been a bit of a slowdown in the level of investment in India in the past, let's say, 6 months. But we attribute that to the kind of unknowns that were connected with the recent general election. Now that that's behind, they move forward with Modi, that we should start seeing some greater momentum building up in India due to confidence and, I guess, more stability and predictability. But hopefully we'll start seeing technology grow really through directives and support from the government as relates to the implementation of what is now called Modi Care, which is essentially the beginnings of a universal healthcare for India. where there has been a promise that 500 million Indians will have insurance coverage or health insurance coverage. I'm sure you'll agree with me that the only way that will be achieved in any, let's say, cost-effective and speedy way will be through the greater adoption and use of technology.
This was the first episode of the short series about digital health in Asia. Coming up next, China with Julie Wang.